On the Death of the Beloved by John O'Donohue. Though we need to weep your loss, you dwell in that safe place in our hearts, where no storm or night or pain can reach you. Your love was like the dawn, brightening over our lives, awakening beneath the dark, a further adventure of color. The sound of your voice found for us a new music that brightened everything. Whatever you enfolded in your gaze, quickened in the joy of its being, you placed smiles like flowers on the altar of the heart. Your mind always sparkled with wonder at things. Though your days here are over, your spirit is live, awake, complete. We look towards each other no longer. From the old distance of our names, now you dwell inside the rhythm of breath, as close to us as we are to ourselves. Though we cannot see you with outward eyes, we know our soul's gaze is upon your face, smiling back at us from within everything, to which we bring our best refinement. Let us not look for you only in memory, where we would grow lonely without you. You would want us to find you in presence, beside us when beauty brightens, when kindness grows, and music echoes eternal tones. When orchids brighten the earth, darkest winter has turned to spring. May this dark grief flower with hope in every heart that loves you. May you continue to inspire us, to enter each day with a generous heart, to serve the call of courage and love.
I got this gig because of my job. I'm a historian. I work in the archives up the street, often alone for long periods of time. Most of my job consists of listening to the dead. But not the same way that other people listen to the dead. We get a lot of people who come through our doors who want to find out about their house ghosts. I'm not embellishing that. The most recent one was Thursday. I don't know if houses really have ghosts. I've never seen or met one, which is a bit disappointing. But I do know how to listen to the dead. They talk all the time, through their writing, their clothes, their diaries, their stories, their pictures, things that they've built or things they've destroyed, their recipes, their poems, their medicine, their school books. You can listen to the dead if you know how. They may not be walking around, eating and sleeping and working like Gomorrah explained to Kinta of the living, but they're very much alive to me. And most of the time, I like hanging around with them. A number of years ago, we, and by we, I mean me and the volunteers who are very much alive, were working our way through a diary. It was written by a 21-year-old schoolboy slash farm boy named B. Judkins Perkins. He was splitting his time between work on his father's farm and going to Phillips Exeter Academy. Because when he was 16, he'd been clearing rocks with his father from the field, and they were using dynamite. There was an accident. He'd lost his left hand. He never mentions this in the diary. We only found this out later. So it must have been decided that he could linger in school a little bit longer than his cousin Moses, who was the same age as him. I'm not actually talking about Perkins today. I know a lot about him. The diary was for the years 1860 and 1861. Now, if you have that historical timeline in your head, it is now pinging with historical notes. This is right before the Civil War, and it corresponds with the year that Abraham Lincoln's son, Robert Todd Lincoln, went to Phillips Exeter Academy. So Perkins was his classmate. But it wasn't the politics or the celebrity that brought us to a grinding halt while working on this diary. It was an entry for the day that Perkins wrote that his cousin Moses went into town on a rainy Friday and engaged a pair of boots of God. We reread that line. We put it away for a few days, which is something what you have to do in transcription. Sometimes you have to put it away and not look at it for a while. And when you look at it fresh, it might jump out at you. And we looked at it again, boots of God. And God was capitalized. What was Perkins telling us? What are boots of God? So we did the kind of thing that we always do in this kind of situation. We researched the living hell out of it. We looked at phrases that might be boots of God. We looked at brand names that might be boots of God. We found very little. There is a lot of Greek mythology about boots of the gods, but it didn't seem like Perkins' cousin Moses was going to wing his way off like Hermes. Was it the old phrase, God in boots, which is a phrase that you use when some dynamic person who seems godlike is on earth with you? Something that you might have said, say, 6 years after this time period when Abraham Lincoln had been assassinated but had rescued the country? Nope, this was too soon for that. So we finally found it. In a list of shoemakers, Thomas Gadd, Boots and Shoes, Academy Lane. It's an ad. Academy Lane is today called Tan Lane. It was called Tan Lane. Originally, it was Academy Lane for a little brief time, sliver in history. Boots of Gadd. It was a spelling and transcription error. Thomas Gadd made boots one pair at a time. It was a bit old-fashioned even for the 1860s. To engage a pair of boots of Gadd, you had to go to his shop, which was located roughly where the Academy Science Building is today, and Thomas Gadd or his son George Gadd would measure your feet in all directions, rough out a last, and then hand-stitch every part. You might have to go back a week later for another fitting. You might have to wait for Thomas or George Gadd to finish with another customer while you were waiting for this process. And this is where Thomas and George Gadd became town legends. Because once you got your first pair of boots of Gadd, you were, according to Henry Shute, who got his first pair at the age of 12, entitled to club privileges of sitting in the little shop and listening to the political discussions, which were thrilling. All manner of men, both rough and intellect, found their way to the shop. Even Robert Todd Lincoln bought a pair of boots of Gadd. George Gadd, who lived until 1921, had this written about him. The little shop on Academy Street was long a town institution, a favorite resort, and many were the interesting discussions held there. The Misters Gadd were men of marked individuality, well-informed, and it was a real treat to hear them discourse on topics that appealed to them. That was in his obituary. Not what school he went to or what his political leanings were. It talked about his boots and the special place that existed while he was at his work. But still at this point, I'm listening about the dead, not to the dead. I don't have a single attributable quote from Thomas or George Gadd. The only picture I could find was this fuzzy little silhouette that was published in the newspaper, so it was fuzzy at best, and even if I'd found the original, it wasn't good. That was a ghost of George Gadd. I wrote an article about him, a bit frustrated that I knew about him, but I didn't feel the connection that I usually get when I read someone's words or see their picture. And it published in September. And then a month after the story ran, because this is how these things go down, right? A month after the story ran, I was walking down the aisle in the archives, glanced to the left and spotted a yellow Kodak box I'd seen a million bajillion times before, but only this time noticed the label said MSS 52, pictures, name, Gadd. And there he was, inside the box. The original is tiny. It's this big. It's like 2 inches by 1 inch, taken with an old Kodak camera in 1897 by Frank Silly, who was a local insurance agent who worked down the Merrill block. He must have been enjoying just snapping pictures of his friends going by, because George Gadd just walked by that day, and he pulled out the camera and took the picture. And here he is. Wow. So here he is now, just looking at you while you look at him. He knew this room. His father was a member of the First Unitarian Society of Exeter. He would have known this room as Unity Hall, so he's looking out at you right now and recognizing you, recognizing this place. And in the picture, he's wearing his everyday clothes, including boots he undoubtedly made himself, boots of Gad. This wise man with a bright, respected intellect who would chat with farmers and president's sons. I know it's just a picture. And I know that I have one-sided conversations with the dead. But these people are very real to me.
Hi, everybody. My name is Susanna Makovsky, and Barbara, I think I also was asked to do this gig because of what I do. I'm a palliative care physician, and I enter in every day to meet families and patients who are approaching that stage of life where somebody in the member of their family, as Martin Nepo says, is becoming a reluctant prophet before they meet their final breath and enter into the group of people and community who are considered those who were before us. One thing that I share with my patients every day is, and their families, is a recognition that while we will miss them, that they have a choice to construct this time of their life to leave not only perhaps their financial legacy that they can talk about with their lawyer, but their ethical legacy. What are the stories that are going to be remembered, and how will they be told? In this way, I get to meet the best of humanity every day. And of course, you know, I get to meet them in loss, or anticipated loss and in sorrow. And we all get to think about the people that we've missed before us, especially in times of deep joy, sorrow, and struggle. And so today, instead of talking about those patients, I thought I would share with you a personal story, one of my own life. I think about my father, who died only about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, not long before I moved to Exeter. And I think about how much he would have loved this town and to have seen Katerina, our daughter, grow up. And I think about my maternal grandmother, a school teacher from Western New York, who loved hats and certainly would have loved my granddaughter's playfulness. And my paternal grandmother, Emma, who loved flower crowns. And I tap into the stories of my family's heritage and their ethical wills to also carry me in times like the fearful time that we're entering now. I recently saw a New York Times video article about fascism. If you're not afraid of fascism, Jason Stanley spoke, you should be. And that video opinion predates the pipe bombs and the attack on the synagogue in Pittsburgh. So I think about what stories in my family can remind me on how to respond in this era. My father, his sister, and mother immigrated here shortly after World War II from Germany. He was born in a small town called Deutsche Eilau and raised in further East Prussia, part of Germany that no longer exists, split between Russia and Poland. My family, the Makovskys, were German. They weren't Jewish or Catholic. The Boy Scouts of my father's time were Hitler Youth. When soldiers raised their right arm in greeting and said those horrific words, Heil Hitler, my grandmother's response was, what, is he sick? Her punchy way out of a moral dilemma. Her husband, my grandfather, earned the label, a star on his chest, Jew lover, after having been caught helping a family out of the country. He and his family lost everything and had to move further east to East Prussia, close to the Russian borders. Then the bombs came in Pilkallen, And my father tells stories of boys when he was about 10 and 11 years old running home in shorts with school teachers and girls dodging bombs from fighter jets. There wasn't a soldier among them. He spoke of being an 11-year-old draft dodger when boys at gunpoint were forced to choose between being shot or chosen or to become an SS officer. My father heard they were coming, and he ran off with some commuter children and hid in the trains that took him to the next town. He was late for dinner that night. One day, towards the end of this period of the war, all the Germans were packing up in their town in Pilkallen because the Russian soldiers were coming in, and the story was if any one of them was still there, they would be killed. My grandfather had been long dead, so my grandmother was packing up her two children, a 13-year-old daughter and an 11-year-old son. She had a Red Cross badge, and so she got on the train right away. But when my father and his sister were asked to raise their hand, they refused and said that's not what they were taught. So the soldier didn't let them on the train. They happened to have keys because their grandfather had worked on the trains and had taught them where the luggage compartment and the animal compartment was beneath the passenger area. So they snuck into the train there. And for the 2.5-hour train ride from East Prussia to Berlin, my grandmother thought she had lost her children for good. They lived in West Germany as refugees. And my father went to the neighboring town, and he was asked to go over there and pick up bread to bring home to my grandmother. And a tinker truck stopped by and offered him a ride home and asked him, so what do you think of Jewish people? And my father told him the stories of how he was raised, of his father, and of how his mother had taught them to respond. And the next day, this man came over to my grandmother with a whole slew of pots and pans and mixing things and said, I am Jewish, and it's because of families like yours that I'm still alive. And so this is a token of thanks. I miss my father. He would have loved Exeter. My grandmother would have loved this town and would have played with such joy, and yet I'm glad that they do not get to read today's headlines. I know that the stories of my ancestors near and far help me with my choices today of how I choose to act in times like this. And I think about, I think about this concept of appreciative inquiry, is we can focus on the horror, or we can focus on the choice that each of us can make of how we can turn the stories around, and of the gratitude of the tinker, and of other pieces of joy that my family had shared with me subsequently. And what I also think about is how the choices that I choose to make today, hopefully, will influence the ethical legacy and will that that future generations after me will be able to tell. So I invite all of us, whether it's our own lineage or the lineage from people in this church or for our ancestors near and far, for we're all connected that way, to inspire us not only in times of joy, but also in times of resilience and perseverance as we reflect in this hour. Thank you.